Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I'm George Chen, and you're listening to SupDoc, a show where normally you would hear me with my co-host Pac Romain talking to some of our most interesting friends from the worlds of comedy, writing, TV, and film about their favorite documentaries. On today's show, however, we're interviewing a director, and it's just me. I came to the home of filmmaker Matt Ornstein in Los Angeles. Matt made one of 2016's most fascinating, complex portraits, Accidental Courtesy, Daryl Davis, Race and America. Daryl Davis is an African-American musician based in Washington, D.C., who ends up confronting and sometimes befriending members of the KKK and other white nationalist groups. I wanted to know more about Matt Ornstein himself, how he came to this project, and what this story says about confronting your enemies face-to-face. Accidental Courtesy is now available on Netflix, and our conversation was before the death of Chuck Berry, or I'm sure we would have gotten to that as well. And now, my talk with Matt Ornstein. All right, we're trying one more time. We got two lovely big old doggies here in Matt's house, Matt Ornstein.
Nice to be here, thank you.
Nice to meet you. I met you at the screening at Los Feliz.
That's right.
We happened to be there. Yeah, and then you happened to be there, and we didn't know you were going to be there. And we looked and they said that was in all the promotion, that you were going to be there for Q&A and stuff.
I popped by a couple just because I live in the neighborhood, and I love that theater, too.
It's an amazing theater, yeah. Now I wanted to ask, okay, so people, the film Accidental Courtesy, it's available, it's streamed on PBS already.
And it showed on PBS and then streamed, and now it's on iTunes, DVD, Netflix, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. And this is a process. I imagine this, you started, when did you first show it?
We first showed almost exactly a year ago at South by Southwest. We premiered on what would be this coming Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been exactly a year.
And then how much pre-production time? When did you start doing all the actual shooting and stuff?
For real work of time I was focused on, it was maybe 2 years and maybe 3 years from when I met Daryl. So for now, from now I'm looking back at 4 years on the project, including the last year of promotional stuff.
Mm-hmm. And so Daryl Davis, where was the first time you heard about him? Was it an article or a radio thing?
It's a newspaper article. I read about him in the paper. It was very, very broad strokes, but I was curious. Then I did a little more research. I read his book, which I think is now out of print, but might come back. And I was pretty determined to meet him and talk to him, but it took almost a year after that for us to link up.
Mm-hmm.
But once he was ready to, I happened to be in New York at the time, so I took the train down to D.C., and he picked me up at Union Station. And he started telling me in the car some of the stories that would become the film. And by the time we reached his place in Maryland, I felt pretty confident that we could make a movie.
Yeah, he has a lot of very good stories, for sure.
That's true. He's a real raconteur.
Yeah. Now, before you did this film, what is your background with documentary, with filmmaking?
I had done a couple documentary shorts, and I had done narrative documentary hybrid that was sort of like a long short. It was like 15-20 minutes, and it was about the last space shuttle flight, and that is sort of what made this possible. That did really well for itself at festivals. And I also did another short that was a documentary about one of the oldest living Holocaust survivors. So it was the combination of Atlantis and the other film Judith that kind of made this something that I could start to put together.
Mm-hmm. And did you come from a film school background, or what was your background?
I did go to film school. I went to Bard College, which is it's got a good film
program. On Hudson.
That's right. Yeah, it's beautiful there.
Been there once, yeah.
I didn't really appreciate it enough at the time, but now I love it.
It's one of those kind of like an evergreen, or like one of these like more like Santa Cruz-y, like do whatever you want kind of schools, I hear.
It's tightened up a lot. Like, I think that it was always a lot of people's, like, safety school that wanted to go to, like, other schools. And as it got more of those people and they focused on the sciences more, it became a more regular school. Mm-hmm. But when I was there, it was sort of the tail end of, like, you could do whatever you want.
When were you there? What class are you?
I'm class of 03.
Okay, yeah.
And it was still, I mean, a lot of smart people, but it was still definitely, like, pretty loose in terms of, you know, allowing you to find your path.
And you were a film
major? I was a film major. You know, I had interest in a lot of stuff at the time. They have a great photography program, a great theater
Barbara
program.
Yeah, Barbara S., right? Teaches there. Did you ever
I think so, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, but I had some classes with Joanne Acolytis, who did a bunch of Philip Glass stuff and is, like, really amazing. And Stephen Shore runs the photography department. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of great talent around there.
Mm-hmm. Were there other people that... What was your film department like? Anyone else come out of that you're in touch with that does a lot of stuff?
Well, it's interesting. The orientation of that film department was very avant-garde.
Like academic, like structural film.
There was academic structural, and there was also, like, the guy who ran it at the time, Peter Hutton, who's unfortunately passed away, made landscape films, mm-hmm. and Peggy Awash.
Peggy Awash, yeah. I know her from music stuff.
Peggy was my advisor.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And so, that's, like, a little more out there. That's kind of, like, getting into video art and politics and stuff. And so it wasn't necessarily a traditional film. But on this movie... Sam Ghazari, the main cinematographer, went to Bard with me. Mm-hmm. Jason Jones, one of the two main editors, went to Bard with me. And I think there's another one I'm forgetting. So clearly there's some community in there.
Did you do college radio or anything like that? Were you involved in music stuff out there? Because I know Peggy Awash, I was in some bands. I think I want to say she was in a band with Glenn Branca, or she was in a band with...
Yeah, that sounds like...
Is that right? Yeah.
That's her scene. I mean, I was always very involved with music and always really appreciated it. I, for some reason, did not have a radio show. I don't know why I missed that opportunity. I mean, I had friends that did, and I'd visit the station and stuff. Mm-hmm. It was like a little one up in Manor, this old house.
Nice. Did you stay on the East Coast, or did you come back here right after Bard?
I stayed on the East Coast for a bit. I lived in Williamsburg. That's kind of where I thought I would stay. And as I started to work more, I was working here. Mm-hmm. And I came back here and just... stayed. It's hard when you're from here, it's hard to live elsewhere.
Yeah.
And I visit, you know, I'm lucky enough I get to go back east a few times a year, maybe more, and so I get to have it in my life. But it's always nice to be in LA.
What kind of work were you getting out of film school that were you getting out here?
I was a director's assistant at first for a while. Mm-hmm. I worked for a big music video director who was kind of segueing into commercials, and you know, I worked on, like, some cool stuff, some Missy Elliott videos, and, like, okay. you know, big like
the fisheye lens.
Yeah, well, right
no,
after
that was
that,
right after that, like, well, 2000, like, mid 2000s, that would have been Skinny Missy period,
the
right
guy, like, yeah, exactly. The guy I directed did, like,
what's his name?
Dave Myers.
Okay.
He did, like, Gossip Folks, and, like, you know, he did Get Your Freak On. He did, like, everything except Super Duper Fly, pretty much.
Okay.
Hype. Yeah. Dave was kind of like the white hype Williams was his thing.
Nice.
So I worked for him and kind of got some set time on that. And then after him, I started being able to do some of my own stuff, mostly videos at first.
Mm-hmm.
But
anything we should look up? Anything you're proud of?
I mean, I have someone on my website. I don't think any of my early ones are on there, but, like, there's some I went on to do that are kind of more conceptual, that are cool. I mean, I still, music videos are a lot of fun. It's just as the bottom sort of fell out of the record industry, they definitely stopped spending money on them.
Yeah.
And it's still a great springboard. Like, if you're young, if you're in college or coming out of college, like, you know, go for it.
Yeah.
But it's hard. It's hard as an adult.
Right.
To do,
yeah. The record labels don't have the money to throw into it anymore.
They really don't.
Yeah. Did you ever stay through South by Southwest? You were there for the film week. Interactive week is this week, right?
I think interactive is, I think it goes film, then interactive, okay. then music. I mean, I've been there for all of it. I used to be there working, like, shooting stuff, like interviewing mm-hmm. bands and stuff sometimes.
Yeah.
And last year, after we premiered and everything, I stayed for a few days and hung out. Mm-hmm. This year, same thing. I'm going to go see some music.
Nice.
I make the most of it.
Yeah. Did you hear about the crazy thing about the people boycotting because of their policy about...
I did.
But, I read, you know, a little bit more about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's a policy that's been in there for a few years. Yeah. I think it's been there at least 4 or 5 years. And what it's really about, as far as my understanding of it, is... you know, they have all these showcases. It used to be blogs. Now it's, like, you know, McDonald's and Coca-Cola and whatever. But they have these showcases, and they get all the same bands. And so why would you buy a badge?
Totally.
And so I think they're just like really looking out for themselves economically.
Yeah, I remember because I used to go maybe like 10 years ago, I would go and it would be the same. Like you could see everyone like at a bridge at 2 a.m.
Yeah, exactly.
With like bats flying overhead.
So like unless you like had an industry job, like why would you get an $800 badge? Like,
yeah. But actually threatening to deport people is like, that's new to me. I guess I never read my contracts well enough to notice that.
Well, it's certainly not friendly. And I mean, you know, what's cool about South by Southwest is the people that founded it are still involved with it. Right, and it has a real community vibe, but it is big business. They're represented by CAA. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they're not immune from trends that are pervasive. Mm-hmm. Now that people have made a comment about that, and it's been a thing, they certainly could consider not using visas as a threat. They could walk that back now.
I think that they changed the language, or they're going to change the language now. So I don't know how many people from the boycott. It seems like more on the band side. I haven't heard anything from the interactive people or anything like from the tech
people. They should say in there that if you fuck around with them, they take you to regular Texas.
El Paso.
Yeah, they drive you outside of Austin to like anywhere else and let them deal with you.
Yeah, exactly. So you did, did you premiere it at South by Southwest last year, or where did you premiere it?
We premiered at South by last year on the opening weekend on Sunday at the Stateside. Mm-hmm. And they took great care of us from the beginning. We had a great premiere slot. We played in great theaters. Mm-hmm. We were playing the morning after the award show, and I'm sure they couldn't have known we were going to win anything, but for us, it worked out really nice because what would have been like a sort of lackluster 11 a.m. screening was full of people.
Oh, nice. Yeah, what was the award that you won that last year?
We won the jury.
Right there. Yeah, it's the jury prize.
South by Southwest Film Awards jury.
Nice.
Documentary feature.
Nice, right
up
there.
It's for portrait documentaries.
And you've got a couple of these statues. Yeah, is that other Film Fest statues? And
Chagrin Falls documentary. We got a public television award there.
Nice.
We won, let's see, Napa
Your
Valley.
Slate. I see the Slate. Oh, you did the Napa Valley Fest. Okay.
Yeah, we won a jury prize at Napa as well. That's a big bottle of wine, so that's not up there. But we've done okay. We won in Calgary.
Yeah. I had heard rumors that maybe you guys were on the short list for Academy. Is that true? Or have you heard much about how that went down, or how the selection went?
I had higher hopes at the beginning for maybe mounting a campaign of some sort, mm-hmm. and getting shortlisted is a big honor. I think the finances involved in mounting even like a half-ass campaign is just really staggering, and that's sort of unfortunate. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, after we didn't mount a campaign, I was kind of kicking myself. But then I saw the stuff that didn't get nominated this year. Mm-hmm. This is a crazy year for documentaries.
Yeah.
Like Wiener didn't get a nomination, which like people thought would maybe win. Gleason didn't get a nomination. Yeah. So at that point, it's like, well, okay.
Yeah. You know? I think what I read that was IndieWire or something, or like one of these blogs posted it. And I guess, I don't know where they got their info, but there is probably like a pre-list of people that are voting in the Academy, right?
Yeah.
And yeah.
So I think someone probably kind of slips to them what they're mm-hmm. considering. You know, I mean, it was a great year for documentaries.
Yeah, it really was.
That's all
I'll
say.
Yeah. Nice. So I noticed that you also work with your brother. Is that right?
I live with him too. He's not home right now, but he lives in the same house.
And so did you bring this idea to him in the beginning, or how do you guys work together?
I had been supposed to direct a feature. It was a high school comedy. I had it kind of lined up for the summer that we originally started this. And I cleared a bunch of time, and it went away. Like, I think they lost financing or something. They definitely – I never got great information on what went down, but I had this chunk of time. And Noah, my brother, said we should – why don't we start on one of these docs? And, you know, the idea was we could do a chunk of it and cut together scenes and kind of raise some money that way. And that's – oh, my God. And that is how we did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I recommend that to anyone. If you have a doc that you're kind of interested in – you know, you can shoot enough to cut together a trailer, a couple scenes, a little sizzle reel. And then at that point, it's much easier for you to be able to raise the rest of the money.
Mm-hmm. And so did your brother have a lot of background in producing before this? Or you guys work together?
He only really
time,
works
or?
With me. I mean, he's worked on some other stuff I did, and he has other peers in the entertainment industry, and I'm sure he'll diversify. But he's a lawyer.
Okay.
And so he kind of has a day job. And then we work together on this stuff.
It's good to have a lawyer working on a film, though, right?
That's definitely a big thing. There's a lot of free contract work and legal consultation that helps in there.
And you have a great soundtrack on this, I have to say. So you had to do a lot of licensing stuff for that, right?
Yeah, you know, for the festival version, I had stuff that maybe I knew we couldn't afford, but like I kind of figured we'd be able to get some of it. And the bill was just staggering. So we wound up having a score made.
Oh, okay.
And we still licensed some songs in there. But what we did, which was very clever, we already had some Charles Bradley songs in there. And the Daptone guys that did Charles Bradley's records, Tom Brennick in particular, who produced and wrote a lot of it, wound up doing our score. So the songs and the score kind of bleed into each other. Mm-hmm. These guys at Exit Strategy, which is a rights clearance firm, kind of hooked that up for us. And Tom was a pleasure to work with. I went out with him to New York. I met him in Woodstock, and we kind of vibed on it, watched the movie, and talked about what the music had to do. Mm-hmm. And then we met up again in New York at their studio. And he was very open and collaborative, and like, it was just a really good, a lot of people have a bad experience with that part of it, mm-hmm. but I had such a good one. It was so much fun for me to kind of play record biz for a couple weeks.
So did you, at South By, that was the soundtrack that you guys all worked on together, or that was the scratch?
At South By, it was all pop cues and a couple score things from other movies. Mm-hmm. It was a temp.
Mm-hmm. It was a temp.
And then that version showed in festivals, and then the version that showed in theaters and on PBS and everything else is the one where we actually, you know, have everything cleared, like normal people.
Nice.
And some songs you can't clear at all. We had Change Gone Come, which I was told was unclearable, and they wouldn't even hear the request for it. And then I saw during the Super Bowl, I believe, a really incredible Nike spot that maybe Mark Romanek directed that had a version of Change Gone Come in it. So I don't know what that cost them, but it was definitely like, no joke.
No, music licensing holds up a lot of people from what I hear.
It's a real racket. I had no idea.
And you have a musician in your thing. So even if you could just have exclusively music was one.
You know, I'd feel better if more of the music went to the artist. Like when you're hearing what they want and stuff, you know, like none of that money is filtering back through. To those. Yeah, exactly.
Like big labels and stuff.
How can you hate me when you don't even know me? Throughout my life, I've been looking for an answer to that. Well, who better to ask than someone who would join an organization whose whole premise is hating people who do not look like them? So I began seeking out members of the Ku Klux Klan. They're not hard to find. You know, they're all over. Well, CNN got wind of this and wanted to do a story. I got the name of the head of the Klan in Maryland, and they said, "Do you think Mr. Kelly will even talk to us?" I said, "I'll do better than that. I'll get Mr. Kelly to come back to my house, and you can interview the head of the Ku Klux Klan inside a black man's house."
And I believe in separation of the races. I believe that's in the best interest of all races.
Does he really? Or has friendship transcended the color barrier? Listen to Kelly at a Klan rally.
I will follow up man to hell on back, because I believe in what he stands for, and he believes in what I stand for. A lot of times we don't agree with everything, but at least he respects me to sit down and listen to me. And I'll respect him to sit down and listen to him.
We're enemies. He's the head of the Klan, I'm a black guy. But he respected me to sit down and listen to him. And in exchange, he sat down and listened to me.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey listeners, are you looking for a new source of documentaries? I know I am.
Well, guess what? There's an app for that. It's called GuideDoc.
That's right, GuideDoc. Discover and watch the world's best hand-picked and award-winning documentaries from around the globe.
There's a new must-see documentary up on the app every day. For example, Sons of Perdition, which is a documentary from 2010 about teens that were cast out of their fundamentalist Mormon community.
Sounds like my upbringing, George. Now sign up through the app and stream all GuideDoc movies for one low monthly subscription of just $4.99.
Yeah, go to guidedoc.tv/supdoc to enter your email address for a chance to get a free month of GuideDoc. That URL again is guidedoc.tv/supdoc, and you can also get GuideDoc in the iOS App Store.
And now, back to SupDoc.
So a big thing that happened since I saw you, since the last couple months, sure. is obviously a guy who's in your all your promo, like all your posters, Frank Ancona.
Sure.
Yeah, from where did he live?
He lived in Farmington, Missouri.
Okay. And he was murdered.
He was murdered, that's right.
It looks like his wife.
It's his wife and her biological son, it looks like. Mm-hmm. And they found his body the day before our PBS premiere.
Yeah, I remember that being like a really weird timing. And did you think that maybe that had something to do with it? Because my initial thought was like, did that have something to do with it? Possibly. Like a gang, you know, because it's a blood in, blood out kind of thing?
It occurred to me, Daryl mentioned it to me before I knew in the paper, because Daryl knew he was missing.
Daryl told me he was missing. Okay.
And, you know, of course your first thought is like, I wonder if this doesn't have anything to do with it. Do we have that big a reach? When we premiered the film at South By, Frank was originally going to come out.
Wow.
That picture of Daryl and Frank shaking hands is from the movie, but I had always envisioned them shaking hands under the marquee of the Stateside Theater, and we had a motel room reserved for him and everything. And at the last minute, he did not come out, possibly because the implications of flying to Austin to appear in a black guy's movie may have...
During South By Southwest,
But because of that, at our premiere, we had a bunch of extra police there. Because they had been warned they were there for crowd control or whatever, and some of them watched the movie, and I got to have a nice talk with them afterwards about it. Yeah. But, you know, Frank is sort of, I wouldn't say he's the emotional heart of the movie, because Scott Shepard at the end, who's reformed, is, but Frank, I always thought was on that road. He was the one we liked the most. You know, he obviously, we don't support a lot of the things he believed or the group he was part of, but he's the most reasonable of the ones we talked to on camera, and his and Daryl's bond is very real.
Right.
Daryl went to his funeral, actually, just to... couple weeks ago. His family wanted him there.
Jeez, yeah.
And that's intense.
Yeah, his family.
The rest of them, yeah, like the other side.
Right, the other people.
It's a good question, yeah. Not the ones in jail.
Yeah, so you've been, how often do you talk to Daryl now? Do you guys have to just do business stuff?
I just emailed with him this morning because Ben Carson... I still don't understand how he's a doctor, how that worked, but you know,
no idea.
With no experience whatsoever in housing or urban development, has been handed the reins of that division. And he commented at this like interior pep talk about how basically like black people got this great free opportunity.
They're immigrants.
Yeah, exactly.
They just wanted to work hard for their children.
And when I heard, I think what a lot of people when they heard that were really confused. I was confused, but less so because I've heard that before. Thomas Robb, the oldest, nastiest Klansman in the movie, he literally says that same
thing. The pastor, right?
Yeah.
Pastor Robb.
You know, what Ben Carson is saying, he's internalized something that nasty, old, racist white men have been saying to justify it. He's made that his own.
Yeah.
And so I immediately was like, Daryl, like this guy. And so we had a little chat about that.
Yeah. What did he have to say? Because the other
he expanded
thing,
on the point pretty nicely, actually. Yeah.
Oh, he kind of agree with it? Is that what you're saying?
No, he agreed with what I was saying.
Yeah,
you know, that like it was a completely insane thing to be institutionalizing.
I would love if it was like you and Daryl talking about Get Out. Did you guys see Get Out yet?
I don't know how hype he is on pop culture, but I love Get Out.
It was amazing.
I went to an early screening where Jordan Peele was there. Uh-huh. And I actually really wanted to give him a DVD or plug my movie, and I was like, because I knew he'd be into it, but it wasn't the time or the place. But
no, I don't know.
I'm hoping he sees it on Netflix.
That movie was amazing. I don't know how Daryl would feel about that, though. It would be really interesting to see what he thought.
Such a biting satire and such good observations, and I've seen some of those things online. I'm sure other people have seen about like things I might have missed the first time, and so now I want to see it again.
Yeah, a bunch of Easter egg-y things
exactly.
in there.
Great symbolism.
Very good. So Frank Ancona, it was interesting because I have a lot of friends that were just like immediately like, yeah, they hadn't seen the movie, so they had no conception of what this guy was like as a person. And I wasn't, normally if I was like, I think before this, if I heard there was like, a guy from the Klan was murdered, I'm like, oh, too bad. But having seen him just operating in a way where he's not spewing the hatred, like just, I guess that's a lot of what Daryl's point is, that he can get through to people in a way where they are acknowledging your humanity, and he tries to do the same to him, but it was, Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard. That's the thing. Like, Daryl has this way of doing that that most people would never do.
And we got a tremendous amount of vitriol about Frank on our page, for sure.
Oh, yeah, like comments and stuff?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
Some of the, you
I'm
know,
sure it's pretty dark.
Our web guy Josh goes in there and, like, gets rid of, like, when it gets too out of control, he, like, pulls it back. But generally, we kind of let it go. And
yeah,
most people were like, that guy got what he deserved, like, good. And, you know, look, he's a Klansman. I'm not going to – even Daryl said when you surround yourself with hate, it finds its way back to you, even though it's not a direct correlative.
Yeah, because it's weird because it has more to do with, like, a domestic issue, it seems like, than with the political aspect.
That's what it seems like, too. Yeah. But, you know, you have to assume that much like when you're in, you know, let's say the mafia, like, your whole world relates to it. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe Frank was sort of on the outer edge of it and his wife didn't like that. Mm-hmm. Your social circle relates to it. Your finances relate to your clan duties. You get paid dues and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. To leave the clan, you really have to uproot your whole life. Your family, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And obviously you hope everyone will do it, but you understand why people might be reluctant.
Yeah. Like I was saying, the kind of blood in, blood out idea, or like it's like a gang, it's not essentially.
Wrong, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess that's just immediately the timing seemed very strange.
Oh, sure.
That was right before your PBS.
I wish we'd been
debut.
More aggressive about getting him to see it. I always wanted him to watch it. We talked about it.
Oh, he'd never seen it.
To my knowledge, no.
Okay.
I mean, maybe he did, but I never heard from him after he saw it, and I would have liked to hear what he thought.
I also heard maybe an interview that you did. Like, you, it's like after some of these interviews, it's like you're not shaking hands with these people at the
end.
Yeah,
Frank, I have like a nice friendly picture with, though. It's actually, it's the weirdest thing. Like, I did a KCRW interview that aired pretty recently, I guess, in conjunction with PBS, and I'd recorded it a month or two before, and I had addressed Frank during it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had said, like, if you're listening, Frank, it's still not too late.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, by the time it aired, it was too late.
It was too late. Yeah, pretty dark. So, let's see. Now, there is a scene I was wondering about. There is this lecture, that the Dew lectures.
Sure.
And I first see it's, like, LAX, and then I see the Bay Bridge. I'm like, okay, they're going to, like, hippie territory.
So yeah, the first lecture when he lands at LAX, then after that there's a lecture at UC Irvine.
Okay, Irvine,
which is what
first.
He was here uh-huh. for. But then there's another one. Yeah, it's up in like is it Sonoma? It's up
like
there.
Somewhere like
yeah.
It was. I could tell. Like it was like you were like oh Northern California.
Well, that's
clearly.
The joke when they yeah. do the, when they do like
the
bell wide the TV
and then like going yeah. like this is like white people right?
Yeah,
this
oh,
is
for sure.
definitely for white people. This is a TED talk for white people.
It's
is
power.
How
yeah, it's like hippie TED talks is kind of how I
yeah.
how I would describe it. For
yeah.
sure.
So it's interesting because the more I've been trying to find interviews with Daryl, he can kind of fit into. Of the different people's ideologies.
Yeah.
And that's what I found interesting. Like there was an interview he did for rare.us and I was like reading it and I was reading that interview and then I was like kind of clicking around that site. I'm like, this is like a pretty like conservative site for sure. So it's weird. There's some stuff that he talks about. And again, it's like, it's more like a thing. There's stuff I should ask him and there's stuff
sure.
that maybe I should ask you. But I know he doesn't talk about it. You don't use it in the film. Does he talk about this idea of like black supremacists?
He mentions in the film a couple
like
times
a couple
black
times.
Supremacists.
Yeah.
yeah. It's not a point that I spend a lot of time on just because it's not an aspect we deal with as much.
Right.
I mean, we touch on it in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, right.
Ideas,
yeah. Because yeah. like, I think one of maybe it was a Q&A that you guys did where he refers to Black Lives Matter as like black supremacists, which is like I was like, I think that's a little of a bold move to make there.
I would if he did say that, I would disagree. And I think that, you know, I mean, he'll
again, like that's something I was.
No, it's
to him
okay.
About.
And
yeah,
he
yeah.
points out a lot that Black Lives Matter is not a group with central leadership.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are kind of each branch does their own thing. I think in general, it's a pretty important movement, and we're going to see a lot of this new administration and its Justice Department doing things like branding them terrorists the same way the FBI said the Black Panthers were communists.
Right, COINTELPRO.
Yeah,
well, yeah
we're going to see a lot of that. And so if there was ever a good time to kind of like circle the wagons and support other groups that we agree with, this is probably that time.
Yeah, and you do spend a lot of time. It seems like when you started this was, what, 2013, 14?
13, yeah.
So it's like then that was the year Ferguson happened, right? So
the reason that's such an element in the movie is that every time we went to go film Daryl, there had been, you know, another officer-involved shooting and accompanying civil unrest. And, you know, when you're making a film that's about civil rights issues and it's very clear that the struggle continues, one of the great things about a documentary is that you can kind of crack it open and make room for more of those ideas. You know, with a regular film, you start, you shoot your days, you're done. If you go back for a reshoot, it's a reshoot. This was broken into like 6 or 7 different units of production, so we had a little more flexibility.
Now, so yeah, like it, I would say that a lot of people's takeaway from this will be the interaction that Daryl has with the people that are organizing for Black Lives Matter in Baltimore.
The most disgusting.
It's got to be the thing. That's the thing that I came away from thinking about it, because definitely like the first part, you just see, and I was talking to my girlfriend about this, and I'm like, it's almost like what it is actually like a generation conflict, maybe.
That's
in a way.
That's how I describe it.
That's how you would say it.
Absolutely.
It's like definitely like it, the way, and it has to do more with like this idea of like respectability and like this idea of respectability politics, and like how he just like, he says Kwame is like a dropout of college, which is true. He's a college dropout. But then it's just like he's throwing it at him in this way that's just like, whoa, he's not treating these Klan members like this either.
I think
it's really intense.
I think Daryl walked in this scenario with these younger guys who he saw kind of standing on the shoulder of his generation's civil rights accomplishments, and they didn't give him the time of day. And so he immediately kind of closed his heart to them and was coming at it from that position of being disrespected. Since then, though, we've done screenings with Daryl and Kwame, and I've done some just with Kwame, and you know, I think they understand each other a lot better now, and they did a great Q&A after one of our New York screenings that I think is on the DVD as a bonus feature. It's really cool.
They both are there, and they're
explaining kind of where, and you know, they still don't agree on everything, but you know, I think they agree more than they disagree for sure.
Yeah, because I think that he had said in the shooting of that there was a lot of stuff that got left out, or he felt like it was.
I mean,
it's a long
scene, and in real life, it's, you know, 40 minutes of these guys yelling at each other. In the movie, it's maybe 10 minutes, and even 10 minutes in a movie of that length is a long time. There's stuff that I wish was still in there, but I think what is in there is a pretty fair representation. It's it's an equal part reduction of what happened.
Yeah, and everyone like obviously like signed their releases and stuff before you guys shot everything.
I mean,
right?
I think there's still I think that I've never talked to anyone who had a problem with their depiction in the movie. You know, I mean, they have a heated conversation, but everyone says things they believe in, and I think that we allow Kwame and Tarek to make some really solid points. I may not agree with everything they're saying, but the economic argument that they present is very hard to refute. You know, there will not be a real measure of equality until black money can stay within that community if it wants to. That's you know, not even an option at the moment.
Yeah, so that's a scene that I remember very distinctly. The other guy I remember is a guy, so you spend a little time with the guy, Jeff, is it Shep? The National Socialist Movement guy in the diner, because he's sort of, I guess you could say, one of the less reasonable Nazis.
he's pretty militant, and he leads a big group. That's like a guy that's current and is out there for sure.
Yeah, and then this also, right after I saw this movie, I think it was around the time Richard Spencer got punched, and I you know, the whole, there's all these like newer, like, Zoolander Nazis or whatever, like the Milo Yiannopoulos. And I know that like the idea, and it's interesting because I've read a lot of things. There's like people that are definitely like, hey, just give them a platform and let them hang themselves by their own ropes. But there's also the case of like Milo Yiannopoulos is like going to a college campus and then like outing a trans student, things like that. The stuff that's more inciting of violence. And I don't know. I'm from the Bay Area, so like when that stuff went down in Berkeley and that stuff got shut down, it's like I'm not punching Nazis, but I'm like I get a little bit of Schadenfreude from it, obviously.
Sure.
And seeing Milo Yiannopoulos get his book deal revoked and things like that. We're just dealing with kind of like new technology Nazis. Here's the thing about what Daryl's philosophy is: you have a one-on-one with someone, face to face. No one in the alt-right, alt-left is doing that because they don't have to. They don't have to have face-to-faces. You can just be as vitriolic as you want without having the responsibility of a face-to-face conversation.
They speak only to their base that already agrees with them.
Yeah, but I think like that's interesting because like if I think he's right about that. Like if you can have a face-to-face with someone, you can get more accomplished. But he's not like, Daryl's not going to go meet up with ISIS, right? He's not going to be like, so what kind of music do you like, ISIS?
Sure, I'm sure he would.
He'd be into that.
I mean, look, it's a hard one. Like, I love when someone like Richard Spencer gets punished, but the problem is that what him and Milo and people like that want is what they want, those kinds of things. They want to get attacked.
That's the problem.
They want to get boycotted. They want to get riots, because then they can show their people how unreasonable the left is.
Right. And that's what has happened, and that is how it's played out. And
I think people need to think about, I mean, obviously, like, there's this whole thing where it's like, don't tell me how to protest. And it's like, well, I am going to say that you should think about who it's for.
Right. That's maybe a good, what's the strategy? Like, if you're Black Bloc versus if you're just like people that were wearing a pink hat at the Women's March, like, that have never gone to a protest before.
Exactly.
It's like, there's a whole spectrum of people that would agree on a lot of things. How do we get them there? And I mean, again, yeah, like, I think that's why this movie, I think, is such a good conversation starter.
Yeah, that was always the goal, was not to necessarily present all the answers, which we by no means have, but just to get this conversation going.
Yeah.
And whenever we accomplish that, I feel good about it.
Yeah, but I guess I'm thinking, like, if you had, could there be like a millennial Daryl Davis? Could there be someone who's like going to go face to face with people, or it's just going to be like, I wrote a think piece and, like, I mean, here's my Tumblr, you know?
If you look at, in general, our preferred modes of communication, and I think in general we're much less inclined to have real in-depth conversations with people. So I don't think it's impossible by any means, but Daryl's sort of from another time when the kind of diplomacy his father did was like, you went somewhere, they like flew to somewhere crazy, and you sat down and like really vibe with that person. That was how diplomacy was done.
Right. Like, that's right. His whole upbringing, and his dad worked for the state. Was he a diplomat or a State Department?
His dad worked for the State Department and became a diplomat.
A guy who would have been laid off recently if he had still around.
Sitting there in a very, very quiet building. Yeah. Well, they gave their first press conference today, I guess.
Oh, they did. After 6 weeks or whatever. Yeah. Today was also election day, so there's a lot going on.
I went out and voted.
Yeah, I did too.
Expecting like a 16% turnout or something like that, I heard.
Yeah, I it's just like people don't even know that it's happening a lot of the time. But I think it's a conversation starter, but I think like there's something to do about his generation versus like this, like, does Daryl have a Twitter? Does he do any of that stuff?
He does not do Twitter. He is on Facebook. I know he messages people. I see that. And he meets some like new reformed racists through that at times. But, you know, he does come with this really old school thing. Even the concept of like really listening to someone, to me, is kind of old school, because the way we take in information, it's like, I don't like what you're saying. You're blocked. I'm changing the channel. Like, that's really, endemic to our intake of media now, just shutting down things we don't like.
Yeah.
But if you're not hearing that, they're also not hearing you, is Daryl's thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes him him.
Yeah, yeah. Have you been more into, since doing all this, do you feel like more like you could reach out to someone, like if someone tries to troll? I'm sure you've been trolled.
I've gotten better about it, for sure.
Yeah.
Because the big, after talking about the movie for forever, what I finally wrapped back around to, which I wish I kind of realized at the beginning, was like, the thing about Daryl and about this movie and this whole idea is, for me, that's so special, is when people believe something that is unpopular to us or really terrible to us, like being an ISIS or like being a Klansman, we kind of view them as someone who has like terminal cancer, like they're just gone forever. But that's clearly not true. Mm-hmm. Clearly these people do have room to change. They do have room to reform. But if we treat them like that's not possible, what incentive are we giving them whatsoever to do that? If we approach all these people like you, sir, are done for the rest of your life,
right?
That's not really workable.
If we make them like untouchables.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the only way we can try to reform some of this sickness is to treat them as people that can make a change. And that's something this project and Daryl has impressed on me.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, when I'm like on our Facebook page and people are awful, my first thing I want to do, I go on their page and I want to talk about their neck tattoos. And then I'm like, all right, like, does that put them in a position where they could hear what I'm saying? Probably not.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the discourse is, like, this movie is almost like, it's like an old school kind of discourse versus what is happening now, like, even with, like, the alt-right people and, like 4chan and all these things.
I think that's very true. And, you know, part of what my brother Noah and Roberto, our other producer, brought to it is sort of this more even-handed thing where it was very important for us to have it be balanced and make it sort of like a more in-depth classic think piece than just leading you in a particular direction.
Yeah, I mean, his stories alone are great. Like, just if you were to just animate his stories,
that would be
pretty amazing on its own. And he's obviously lived an amazing life, this guy.
He lives and will continue to, and he's still meeting people and having adventures. We just did... Last weekend, we lectured together at William & Mary College in Virginia. And, even then I heard a story from him I hadn't heard before. Mm-hmm. So even now it's possible. Yeah.
I was wondering, this came up, I think my girlfriend and I both thought about this. He talks a lot about having a white wife. Did she just decline to be in the film?
Yeah, she doesn't like being on camera and she's a little shy. And CNN, for a previous piece, had talked her into it. And she hadn't been good on camera, and they hadn't used her, and that was sort of the kiss of death on that.
Okay.
It was rough for me because I really wanted her in there. At some point off camera, she told me that she admired what he did but worried for his safety, which is like totally the kind of thing you want in the movie.
Yeah.
I also wonder if on some level maybe Daryl doesn't like putting her out there just for fear that like some reprisal could affect her. It was the kind of thing where I understood and didn't want to push too hard, and we got her in there through those photos. You know, he has a white wife, which I think is interesting.
Yeah.
And that discussion with Thomas Robb where he says it's reprehensible.
I saw another podcast that Daryl was on where he talks a little bit more about like going to meet one of the first – maybe he was meeting up with Roger Kelly, I think, the first time where he was with a white woman and how there was this whole other dynamic in that. Yeah.
And that's a great example. It's this whole story. They go to a motel and they meet and everyone's on edge. And like there's this cracking noise and like when the bodyguards goes for his gun and it's the ice bucket. It's this whole great story. And the thing is like it's maybe like by itself like a 5 or 10 minute set piece.
Yeah.
And it's like, damn, we don't have time.
Yeah.
You really don't though.
Yeah.
Like, the movie's 96 minutes. It's
stuffed
to the gills. Like,
what was the first cut? How long was the first?
I mean, there's like a 3.5 hour version of it like, that doesn't even have the whole last act. Was the last thing we shot pretty much. So there's like a 3 hour version that doesn't even have that.
Yeah, right, because you had to add the postscript with Trump got elected,
but then also the stuff in Baltimore and the stuff with Scott Shepard in D.C. After we got our premiere date, I was able to get a little more money and go back and shoot more because we didn't have a real ending yet.
Yeah, right. So do you feel like Scott Shepard represents more of an ending?
It was important to me. It all kind of came together organically, but, you know, as the scene in Baltimore sort of really put in question some of Daryl's ideals and what they were worth, it then was even more important to show the other side of that. And luckily, Scott was already something that was happening.
Right.
And so that's sort of the other side of that. It's like, is what Daryl does the end-all be-all for this problem? Is it the only thing to do? Certainly not. Mm-hmm. But does it affect a noticeable difference in some people's lives? Well, clearly, because we can see a couple of them at least.
Yeah. I mean, I really like that one quote from, I wrote down Mark Potok, is that how you pronounce it? From the Southern Poverty Law Center, where he's like, he seems a little bit exasperated with Daryl. He's like, you're like the retail equivalent.
Sure. Wholesale,
I'm
retail.
Doing the wholesale. And I thought that was, it's more like almost like Jehovah's Witness versus like wholesale.
So, I mean,
like door to door salesman, Mark, like Willie Lomaning for like,
against
racism.
I mean, Mark's a fierce intellect, and actually, I hear him so much on the radio and on TV now. Mm-hmm. He like kind of has become the go to guy under this new administration.
Yeah.
So Mark is just great, and we were really grateful that he was willing to participate in the Southern Poverty Law Center was. There's no one better for these kinds of issues than them.
Yeah. Do you feel like because of what's happened with basically this resurgence of hate crimes, like straight up people knocking over headstones in Jewish cemeteries, all this stuff that obviously if we want to just do a documentary about like everything shitty that's happened since the election,
you could.
That would be a whole thing to get into, but
you can do it.
Yeah. Like, do you feel like before you knew this was going to be what that was, I don't know. Does it feel like in the climate that we're in now, the movie serves a different function?
It does somewhat. I mean, mainly in the sense that when we were starting the project, we kind of felt the need to reiterate to people at the beginning of the movie, hey, these things exist. These are real factors. Don't ignore them. And if we were making it today, we probably wouldn't feel the need to do that because they're so apparent in our society.
They're just like on the surface.
That's right.
And I actually, there was a follow-up, I think, on Love and Radio with Daryl where he says like, oh, yeah. Like he said, the one good thing with Trump is like it's bringing it all to the surface. I hear this all the time.
Yeah.
I hear it all the time. Like, okay, well, now I can see it. But is that better?
I mean, you know, Daryl Daryl, like a lot of black people, were not as surprised.
Right.
It's like, oh, you don't think that's what America's like? And especially for those of us that live in a coastal region, we don't think that's what America's like.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Life. Right. You know, I think maybe we're living...
Well, because we live with immigrants and right. people of color, and like, it's not a big deal.
Maybe we live 10 or 20 years ahead of certain other parts of mm-hmm. the country. I still think they'll get there. Mm-hmm. I just don't know if we were on the timeline we thought we were.
Well, we're definitely on a weird timeline right now. That's for sure.
Michael Wood is a very honest individual. He was not liked by the Baltimore City Police because he didn't play the good old boy network game.
I want police to actually find ways. When they see a drug dealer in the corner... to figure out what the root cause is. He doesn't want to be on that corner. Drug dealer's probably the worst job. Cops are looking for you, robbers are looking for you, other drug dealers are looking for you. So it's the worst job in the world. They don't want that job. So actively find a way to solve that problem. So if he can't get a job because he's got a felony conviction, well, we need to find a way, an employer that will take him, or we need to fight and say, look, we can't put felony convictions on applications because it's sowing the seeds of crime.
I mean, yeah, you included a lot of like stuff that you needed at the time, like everything explaining like a short like 5-minute thing with everything that happened from Trayvon to Ferguson to like Dylann yeah. Roof. And
I mean, that's just, you know, we're kind of connecting the dots right there. It's something that, you know, I mean, at the time, you don't know what's going on. We don't know that the 13th is coming out, which does like right. a much bigger, badder, by bad, I mean better, like job expanding on those viewpoints. But yeah, you know, the concept that civil rights continues because slavery continues in institutional forms is vital to any discussion about race. Mm-hmm. So this movie, the trap we were trying to avoid is pretending to be the end-all be-all of race discussion movies, but you want to touch on that too.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's this thing that watching, having, when I was coming out of theater, I did have like so many thoughts coming out of this, coming out of theater. And one thing was that idea of like, we have this other problem, and that's what Get Out is really about, yeah. is about like people that think they're liberal and not racist, but are, you know, like, and there is like the sort of the problem of like dealing with institutional racism. And whereas what Daryl's doing is dealing with these outliers that are very, yeah. very extreme outliers. So it is frustrating because it feels like if he, you know, cause he is going rogue, he's just kind of doing his one man thing.
I think there's a symbolic value people maybe don't take into account. Mm-hmm. Like for other people that may live in that life and be part of those groups or be race, and they see that there is the potential for some kind of acceptance and redemption, that's sort of powerful. There was recently Daryl and Scott were on Steve Harvey. Okay. Like it was like a daytime talk show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it wound up being a weirdly powerful reconciliation between Scott and Steve Harvey. Which was like totally not what I expected at all, but it's like a tremendously powerful moment.
Wow.
Where Steve forgives him. And I think when stuff like that, like for someone who is sitting there watching it, mm-hmm. who, you know, is surrounded by hatred and they see that that is possible, I think it might open a door for some people. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Well, because I know there's also like people that are like white people that are former white supremacists that have come yeah. out on the speaking circuit and like have a lot to say.
That's right. And I think that that's too, yeah. super positive. And mm-hmm. I think Daryl encourages that kind of thing yeah. more so his existence does.
Yeah. So you're going to be working on, you have another project you're working on? Is this something you can talk about yet or not yet?
Not really yet, but I have a new film I'm kind of ramping up for. It's another documentary. It's a little bit political. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited about it, kind of getting in deeper on it.
Yeah. I'm sure that's going to be, like based on the how much came out of watching this and how many discussions came out of this. I'm looking forward to what else you work on. Now, you also like doing narrative film? You like want to do both?
I think the third film will be a narrative film if it all works out. And then hopefully I'll be able to keep doing both. This great thing has happened in the past bit where you don't have to pick anymore.
Right.
You know, you can kind of have both going on, and there's so many great people to work with, from online to cable to whoever, that mm-hmm. there's all kinds of places to tell your story now. Mm-hmm. And so...
Yeah. When did you get into documentaries? In college or...
I've always been into them. I kind of grew up when I was younger. It was like that later golden age of docs when We Were Kings and Errol Morris and all this stuff was happening. And they mm-hmm. were in theaters. Everything was still in theaters. So you'd go see these docs. And, you know, when I'm in college, I get that Jean-Luc Godard quote where it's like the best films are like documentaries. The best documentaries are like films. And I really do think that's true. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of these movies that I was referencing for other stuff over here, like, you know, Zero Dark Thirty and United 93 and like JFK and all these movies. And then there are a bunch of documentaries there. Like those movies are like documentaries. They kind of like blur mm-hmm. this line where you're not sure what's what. And I find that really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, you have always been a fan of that format then, yeah.
I've always enjoyed that. I enjoy Verite in general. And I enjoy documentaries as they're sort of like long essays. And the same reason it's more fun to do a podcast than maybe like a more traditional interview is you get to go deeper into things. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of links back with this thing we were talking about Daryl and his old school philosophy. Like, you know, he sits down in person and he goes deeper into things. Mm-hmm. And we live in a very soundbite oriented time. So it's nice. Yeah. It's nice to counterbalance that.
Thank you so much for talking with us here on SubDoc.
Oh, it's such a pleasure talking with you. And, you know, I look forward to talking to you more about the next one.
Definitely hit me up when it's coming out. Yeah,
you know, I will.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
You can find episodes of SubDoc on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please subscribe, review, and rate.
For show notes and more information about George and Paco's appearances, visit supdocpodcast.com. You can send your corrections, questions, or comments to supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
We'd also like to thank Documentary News for their continued support. Please check out documentarynews.com.
Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook @supdocpodcast.
This show is produced by Will Scovel and our theme music by David Siegel.